Welcome to Cannabis Health Radio, a podcast where we share stories from people around the world who are using cannabis as medicine. The information is meant to raise awareness about the health benefits of cannabis, but should not be taken as medical advice. Now, here are your hosts, Ian Jessup and Corey Yelland.
And we welcome you to another episode of Cannabis Health Radio. I'm Ian Jessup.
And I'm Corey Yelland.
Degenerative disc disease is not really a disease, but a condition that happens when one or more discs between the vertebrae of the spinal column deteriorates or breaks down. It can be extremely painful. Today we're going to talk to a young woman who ran marathons, was a dance instructor, and then degenerative disc disease reared its ugly head. Joining us from Cincinnati, Ohio, to tell her story is Gabrielle Dion Visca. Gabrielle, good of you to do this. We appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks for reaching out to us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I really think it's important to tell these stories, especially because it can help other people. And so I'm happy to talk about what I've been through and experienced, and in the hopes that it will help some others and maybe inspire some people to try some different holistic alternatives to pain medicines.
Perfect. That's exactly why we do this show. Now, do you remember when you first noticed that you had a problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was very active through my 30s. I had actually lost 100 pounds in order to run a marathon, and really enjoyed marathoning as an exercise. And through my training, I found Zumba as a cross training method, and I loved it so much that I started teaching it as well. So between my marathoning and my running, I was doing a lot of physical activity, and it really happened all of a sudden. I was teaching a second class of the evening after a long day of work when I noticed my feet had started going numb. And I thought maybe it was just my footwear or something temporary, but it just kept happening. And I eventually went to a surgeon and got an MRI, and he told me that I had degenerative disc disease. And in my case, I was young at the time, 39 years old, and it really changed the way that I could live. I couldn't teach Zumba anymore. I couldn't run marathons, and within about 6 months, I was fully disabled. I couldn't, I could barely walk. So it was a very fast condition for me. I relied very heavily, especially in the early days, upon opiates in order to just get around, to just get myself up and get dressed in the morning and so forth.
Gabrielle, what did the doctors tell you about your condition?
Yeah, my doctors, after I saw the MRIs, we worked on a lot of different preventative measures. I worked with pain management, went to a pain clinic for many months, and they had suggested some injections, some of the first-line treatments that you typically see when people have back pain are injections of different steroids that can help that can help loosen it. But when you have degenerative disc disease, it's just that constant pounding, and it never really improves. Some people do get improvement from the injections, but it was my experience that they were just continually making me worse, and I was even more reliant upon pain medicines.
What was go ahead, Corey.
Go ahead. I was going to say, this must have been really difficult emotionally for you too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's your whole world changing. And I was about to get married when all of this happened. And my husband and I have since divorced. And of course, the injury and the disease really was a big factor in my marriage and divorce, as of course it has to be. You know, it becomes your whole life. And what was so hard was, you know, he married someone who was, a dance instructor and a marathon runner and a physically active and healthy person with a good attitude toward life. And, within a year of our engagement, he saw an entirely different person. And that had to be very hard for him. But obviously it was very hard for me as well. And I decided within about a year of dealing with all these injections to go ahead and get surgery.
Now, tell us about that. What was that like?
Yeah, the first surgery was sort of a preventative measure. They had intended to go in and loosen up my L4 and my L5, loosen the space in between there, because in degenerative disc disease, what happens is it's kind of like if you have old brake pads on your car and they start to wear down. Much like your car hitting metal on metal, I was hitting like bone on bone, disc on disc, with no fluid in between the joints. So what they were attempting to do with the first surgery was to give me a little bit more room in there. And of course, the insurance comes into play with it as well. They could only repair one disc in the first surgery because of insurance reasons. So they did the best that they could, and I started to attempt to rehab, and a pedicle screw that was part of what was keeping my fusion together, it had come dislodged. And this was about 6 months after the surgery, and I noticed very quickly that it changed my gait, and it became almost impossible. I had gotten back rehabbing to about the point where I could walk again, mm-hmm. pretty comfortably. And I was rehabbing in a pool, doing a lot of swimming. But when the screw dislodged, I no longer had any control over this.
Could you feel the screw in your back?
I could actually, well, I couldn't feel it from the outside, but I know the moment when it came out, because I felt it.
Yeah, you had the sensation that it was dislodged.
Yeah, and then I got up. I was actually laying down when it happened, and I got up, and I noticed immediately that my gait, I had to hold on to things to walk, I started using a cane and walker thereafter.
Is it common for that to happen?
No, it's really not. But back surgeries in general, especially lumbar surgeries in degenerative disc disease, are not terribly successful typically. There's not a good success rate with a first surgery. And then, of course, because the screw came out, then we were looking at the second surgery. And in the meantime, I broke my foot. So,
I don't mean to laugh at it, but it means.
I know, right? I laugh too, but it's one of those ironies, right, of life, that the worst thing happens when you're already dealing with the worst thing, right?
So, Gabby, do I ask how you broke your foot?
Well, yeah, it was related. I started after the screw came out after the first surgery, my entire right side had developed sort of a numbness, and especially toward my ankle and foot. And I slipped and fell, didn't feel it was actually my cat's food bowl, and I didn't feel it below me, and it just slipped, and I went flying, and it shattered, and had to have my two bones in my foot repaired, as well as put a rod in my foot. So I had that surgery, and then not 6 months later, I was back for my second back surgery, which was what they did in the second back surgery was they took out the L4, L5 fusion that they had previously done, basically started over. And it was an 8-hour surgery, grueling. They were able to put in new hardware. So at the time I had the latest upgrade, which was a nice thing to be positive about, that they were putting in the very latest in infusion hardware. And the second surgery was a little bit more successful. I was by that point, after three surgeries and 5 years of this, I was hopelessly addicted to opiates, and I wanted to get off of them. But, you know, how do you do that when you have chronic pain? And I think, that's probably one of the areas you might, that we talk about a lot, right? That, I can't go to an addiction recovery center that wants me to get sober, because there's no over-the-counter medicine that's going to control my pain. And most of the other pain medicines were either also addictive or ineffective. So,
how many pharmaceuticals were you taking a day?
Oh, goodness. Yeah. At the worst of it, my prescribed medicine was up to four Vicodin a day. But there were days that the addiction became so uncontrollable that there were times that I took up to 20 Vicodin a day. And, I shouldn't be alive after doing that. And probably, there were a lot of days that I had hoped it would kill me. The amount of pain and the lack of relief that I was even getting from something that was from this thing that was addicting me and making me feel sick and giving me lots of side effects, just ruined my life, ruined our whole lives. And at one point, we asked a surgeon, my husband actually asked the surgeon, he says, what can we do to get her off of these medications? And he it was the surgeon in Nevada who suggested medical cannabis. I had grown up and lived most of my life in Ohio, where it was not only illegal, but where the stigma is probably the strongest of anywhere. It's a very, very closed, conservative area of the country. Mm-hmm. And so going to Nevada and being in a state where I could use medical cannabis was a lifesaver to me, being able to try something different than was even presented to me before. So, So it was very interesting to me at first to try the cannabis. I had only ever really tried it maybe once or twice in my life. I had, done the pass the joint and took a little bit of it, probably improperly. And I would definitely say that in my 20s and 30s, I believed a lot of the stigma. I was a product of the, Nancy Reagan, the Just Say No and the DARE program. And I believed a lot of that. So I was really reluctant to give cannabis a try. And what was interesting is the first dispensary I went into might have caused me never to try it again. I went in somewhere that they kind of expected me to know what I wanted. And expected me to understand the ins and outs of cannabis when I had never tried it before. And it was a disappointing experience. And I went home and really did, tried it a little bit. I think it was a pre-roll, and I coughed a lot, and the coughing hurt my back, right? Mm-hmm. So I decided I can't do this anymore. I can't keep going with cannabis. So I put the idea aside for probably 2-3 months. And then my addiction had gotten out of control again, to the point where I had to face it. I had to say, well, you know, let's try this cannabis out again. So I went to a different dispensary, and it was a whole different experience. I went to a dispensary where there was a woman who had a similar condition, and she and I spoke about the, you know, the struggles that I was having with opiates, and she suggested that I try edibles. And that made all the difference for me. I went home, and now the first experience wasn't pleasant. I will say I definitely took too much
too
the first time, and I sort of felt like I was in lost in a time continuum for a bit. But after that experience, I learned a little bit better how to dose and how to appropriately dose, and also what to do if I dose too much. And over the years now, I've really learned how to use cannabis effectively. So I've been 2 years now opiate free.
Wow, Gabrielle, what do you say to people who might be listening who say, "Yeah, I'd like to give this a try, but I don't want to be high. I'm you know, who have a fear factor involved." What do you say to them?
Right. So cannabis doesn't have to make you high. There are plenty of ways that you can take cannabis and be completely in control of yourself and still enjoy the pain relief that that can help you to get through your day. It's difficult because I think a lot of patients had my same experience, and you know, a lot of that is where we are right now with a new cannabis industry in the States, where you don't have a consistent experience going into dispensaries, and especially with medical patients, getting that proper counseling in order to get the right cannabis is so important because. Yeah, because especially with opiate-addicted people, there's such a small window of time in there that you're going to be receptive to it.
It's interesting. I just had a conversation yesterday with somebody who owns a dispensary in Oregon, and they were talking about the very fine line that they walk because legally they're not allowed to hand out, in quotations, medical advice. Yeah. So their hands are somewhat tied. And they walk a really fine line, and I hadn't really even thought about this before. They walk a really fine line in what they're allowed to tell people who come in seeking help, because it can absolutely backfire on them, particularly in the States where lawsuits run rampant. Hey,
Absolutely, and especially in Ohio, because we are one of the most restricted programs in terms of marketing. So the dispensaries and cultivators have very little that they can actually tell the patients about the products. So what's interesting is one of the ways that I found myself out of the addiction, in addition to cannabis, was by developing a passion project around it. I happened to be a medical writer already, and was working as a medical writer when I moved back to Ohio and decided that I wanted to develop some patient education for new cannabis users, because Ohio began their program just in the beginning of 2019. So I launched our publication, Medicaid OH, in March of 2019 to support the industry. What's interesting is that we have this great publication with all this medical information, and it's all medically reviewed by doctors in Ohio. But what's really interesting is that the cultivators and the dispensaries aren't really able to support it. So we've got a real disconnect and a real problem there in Ohio, and our hope is that keeping an eye on legislation and looking to find ways to change the program and to loosen those restrictions are going to be the way that we move forward with it.
Right.
Gabby, you said you've been clean of opiates for 2 years. How long did it take you to wean yourself off using edibles?
Yeah, that's a really interesting story that I'd love to tell. I actually got off of opiates when I was in Nevada. I was able to successfully transition and did so for several months. What was nice about Nevada was that I had a compassionate pain medicine doctor who allowed me to utilize my opiates while I was transitioning to cannabis. And that made a huge difference for me because in Ohio currently, most, and I think this is true of a lot of medical programs in a lot of states, their insurance program, their insurance and a lot, there are other factors as well, but a lot of pain clinics will kick you out if you test positive for medical marijuana. And that is exactly what happened. And I knew that it was about to happen in Ohio. And when I moved back to Ohio, I moved back in 2018 and we didn't have a medical program yet. So I had to make the really, really difficult and controversial decision to go back on opiates for a year. So I did that for 2018. And then once the medical, I was one of the first in line to get my medical card in Ohio at the beginning of January 2019. However, the program didn't have actual cannabis to sell until March, and they didn't have adequate cannabis to sell until July. So I finally felt in July of 2019 that I could transition from opiates to cannabis safely, and so I did so, and I've been off for 2 years now.
Gabby, I know you mentioned that you did smoking and edibles. Mm-hmm. Did you try any other modes? And what do you find to be most effective for you? How much are you taking a day? And typically, what does an average day look like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I, you know, like a lot of cannabis patients, I've meandered through all of the different forms of administration to see what works properly for me. And I've found that I don't like to smoke it necessarily. If I do any sort of ingestion, I like to vaporize it. And I will do occasionally, if I have acute pain, I will take a dab and do a concentrate of a high THC concentrate. But I normally, my day-to-day pain relief had been for many years strictly just edibles. But I've moved to taking RSO along with edibles, because edibles, especially the sugary ones, aren't so great on the diet. So and I find that RSO is really, really helpful for pain. So I like to try to mix it up between the RSO and the edibles. And then I just do the dabs occasionally, like I said, when I have acute pain.
Are you doing any CBD along with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that goes in practically every article that I write, which is that especially for chronic pain patients where you're taking a high THC level, it's so important to have CBD on hand in order to bring that high down if you get too high. And also I normally tell patients who ask me now to look for things with a good balance of CBD and THC, because it just, I feel like they just act better when it comes to pain. Yes. I think that entourage effect is a real thing. And I even think, especially for new patients that get into it, having something that's very heavy in CBD is a great way to kind of start into it.
Hey.
Having a big hit of THC all at once, like I said, can you know, rip a hole in the space-time continuum.
Can be overwhelming. Yeah. Let's just be clear that the CBD we're talking about, we're not talking about the CBD from hemp that's at your 7-Eleven.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, that's a big issue that we talk about too, is that the CBD that is already in a lot of strains is probably the best way to get it. I know a lot of cultivators and processors now add CBD to products in order to give them a more balanced profile. And I think that's great. It's interesting, though, the way that these isolated compounds are starting to kind of make their way in. And I'm trying to keep up with the science on CBN and CBG and Delta 8 and all of these other isolated products, just to see, you know, whether they're effective or not. You know, I like to try things because you just don't know. You know, you may have the best product that you haven't even tried yet. But typically for me, I find RSO and edibles to be the best way for me to medicate. Although, you know, I will say one thing that's come into the market lately is beverages to the Ohio market. And I used to like to drink those in Nevada because I felt it helped me to drink less alcohol. And, you know, like a lot of people, alcohol became part of medicating. You know, you do whatever you can, you reach for whatever you can. And I'm proud to say that I, you know, I've not had a problem at all with alcohol since I've used cannabis. And I think some of that has to do with these drinkable beverages. There are some squeeze products now too on the market where you can just put it into your tea, and you know, it's nice and discreet. I think a lot of those products help you microdose, which, you know, if you're a busy person during the day, you kind of have to do. You can't have a big a big couch lock session if you've got three meetings, right?
Gabby, right. give us an idea of what life is like for you today compared to when you were addicted to opiates at your lowest point.
Oh, goodness. I mean, I think about this a lot, obviously, but yeah, it was a totally different mindset. Opiates put me into a mindset where I was the victim and where these were pills that I was taking in order to bring me momentarily out of that victim mentality and out of my pain. And but that was it. You know, it stopped there. It didn't do anything more for me. What I find with cannabis is that it's a totally different experience. One of the key aspects that I've noticed that's different about cannabis than opiates is the element of gratitude. For whatever reason it is, and I'm sure it's somewhere we'll discover in the endocannabinoid system, but it activates gratitude. And what I'd found is I also do a lot of yoga in order to keep my back loose and keep it from getting too sore. And I found that cannabis allows me to thank the pain. And I know that sounds really weird, but it teaches me that the pain is there so that I can appreciate those feelings of comfort. And the intensity of the pain are there as lessons to me. And I don't think I would have come to those conclusions, those emotional connections to my condition if not for cannabis. Like I said, I think it's just a difference in energy. Opiates put you into this mindset and this energy of defeat, of giving up, of masking and blocking pain.
Oh, it's a huge downward spiral.
Right, right. And, you know, and our legal system doesn't help it. Our legal system and our the way that our medical, especially in America, how our medical system has really done a disservice to patients who not only get prescribed opiates for pain, but then have to somehow get off of them. And they don't provide that kind of support. And it's also still, I think, very widely seen as a moral failing. And so I think that those are the changes that, you know, that I've seen that cannabis has helped me to see that that my pain doesn't have to be a life sentence, and I don't have to use use a medicine that I have to either obtain illegally or that I have to that is going to give me such bad side effects that it won't that my life is still hardly worth living.
Gabby,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, do you feel better each day or each month this goes on? And are you getting better or are you just maintaining?
Yeah, I think that I'm getting better. I don't, the hard thing about any degenerative disease is that you have to understand that it probably won't ever improve. Mm-hmm. That it's going to continue to get worse throughout my life. But cannabis has really helped me in therapy and some other things as well. Lifestyle changes really helped me to see that this isn't a disability isn't a life sentence. In fact, in many ways, I appreciate that this happened to me, because I don't think that I would have gone down the path that I did in terms of my job and my passion and so forth if it weren't for this injury. So I do. I really think that it's a different experience with cannabis. I think a lot of people can benefit from trying it as an alternative, especially if they're struggling with a lot of the legal problems with opiates, and it's really just a hassle to get opiates. I don't know what it's like in Canada these days, but it's still
it's no different here than it is there.
Yeah, it's such a hassle. I mean, you have to go in every month and do a test, and it's hours wait in order to get to get your medication, and then there was always some BS thing about you can't get it till Thursday because last month you got it on Tuesday. And I mean it's interesting when you analyze it from this perspective now of being able to go up to my local dispensary and get my product and go home and within 15 minutes. All the BS that I went through in order to just make myself moderately comfortable. And it's sad. I mean, it's really sad that that more people who are in chronic pain situations are stuck in that loop.
That's why we like to interview people like you in order to get the message out. And I think you have a remarkable story of what you went through and your recovery. Mm-hmm. And we're very appreciative of you telling this story. Thank you very much.
For sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gabby.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We'd very much like to thank our listeners for supporting us and sharing our podcast with others who would benefit from hearing these testimonials, like the one you just heard, about the healing power of cannabis. Our purpose in doing this, right from the start, is to help as many people as we can. We hope that these podcasts do that. We are listener-supported. And if you'd like to make a one-time donation or a monthly donation, regardless of the amount, go to our website, Cannabis Health Radio, and a drop-down menu will show you how you can do that. We are very grateful for your support, and thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of Cannabis Health Radio.
Thanks for listening to Cannabis Health Radio. For more information and to search previous podcasts, visit our website, CannabisHealthRadio.com. Subscribe so you don't miss new episodes. And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. This podcast is made possible by donations from our listeners. If you found the information helpful, please consider making a donation in any amount through our website. You can also help us share our message by leaving a review on your podcast listening platform. We are very grateful for your support. Thank you.